I'm Len.
I'm Angela.
Well, welcome. I am happy that people showed up at all for a Friday afternoon session on sex abuse. Not the happiest of topics. My name is Jason DeRose. I use he/him pronouns. I serve the Village on faculty and also on the board of directors. So if you want to talk about this class or whatever you want to talk about Holden Village, I'm happy to do it. When I'm not here, I am the Western Bureau Chief for NPR News and the Senior Editor for Religion and LGBTQ Issues at NPR. So I edit those 4 to 7, 8 minute pieces that you hear on Morning Edition and All Things Considered and Weekend Edition. So that is the bulk of my work. What you hear in there is that I am also the religion editor, which means that I oversee our religion correspondent and a bunch of freelancers who cover religion, and you're going to hear a couple of pieces from religion freelancers, a religion correspondent, and myself, because I used to be a religion reporter. For the first 15 years of my career, I was an on-air reporter, and then about 15 years ago, I became an editor, which sometimes makes me sad because I love telling stories myself, going out into the field, but I actually get to influence coverage and do a lot more, bring a lot more stories to the audience because I'm working with many, many reporters at once, and if I were still a reporter myself, I would be able to do one story at a time. So at best, I could maybe do 50 pieces a year myself, but instead I can bring in hundreds of pieces if I work with many other reporters who cover the topic. So today's session is on reckoning with sexual abuse. And I'm going to read the description that I gave because I think it helps frame why I cover religion at all, and specifically why I cover sex abuse within the church. So many religions traffic in power and trust and vulnerability. They also traffic in morality, which is often defined as regulations over sexuality. And the confluence of these factors have led time and again to the abuse of that power, specifically sexual abuse in churches and in mosques and in synagogues. And this session is going to explore the ways in which several groups have addressed that abuse, or whether they've addressed that abuse, or continue to address that abuse. So can anybody think of the most recent church to be rocked, national church to be rocked by a sex scandal?
Liberty
University, okay, that's evangelical.
Yeah, the most recent. Yeah.
Right, Liberty University, there was the very odd situation with the president, who may or may not have been having some sort of complicated relationship with other people and his wife. Mm-hmm. How about a national church body recently? It's been in the news all summer.
FPLF.
I can't hear you.
The FPLF Church from the Mormons.
Oh, the Fundamentalist Church of Latter-day Saints. Okay, that's another group that has been in the news recently. One that I have been thinking of is the Southern Baptist Convention, which just a few weeks ago, like I think it was 2 weeks ago today, they announced that the U.S. Justice Department was investigating them because of their history of sex abuse. Early in the summer, or late spring actually, they released this gigantic report where they had been an internal investigation on sex abuse within their own ranks, usually, adult male clergy abusing adult women in some way or other. I mean, sometimes it was like actual rape, sometimes it was inappropriate relationships. So it was like a whole range of inappropriate relationships, meaning consensual, but still you shouldn't, even if it's consensual, you shouldn't be having an affair with a pastor. So that investigation internally came out, and I was interested in how, I mean, I was interested in the specifics of, you know, this many thousands of women over this many years, and the churches kept the records, but didn't actually do it. They knew who the abusive pastors were, but they didn't do anything to stop them. They just wanted to collect this information, similar to the way that the Catholic Church has had kept records to know who was where, and frankly, it wasn't that hard to tell, like, priests shuffling around a lot or being sent to Central America. I still think the next big story in Catholic clergy sex abuse will be the exporting of abusive priests to Latin America, where I think that there is abuse going on rapidly today.
They wouldn't be stopping it necessarily.
Right, right.
So maybe I'm reading into some things I've heard over the many years, because I've been clergy. Mm-hmm. And how is it, maybe it'd be something that would come up in your own research, at least from what I've heard and what I read, why is it the most conservative churches, the ones that bang the Bible the mm-hmm. most, are the ones that usually are into the, is it refreshing?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. And one that the second piece we'll try to get at, because quite often some people are blamed when they're not actually the perpetrators. Mm-hmm. This happens a lot in the Catholic Church, and so the second piece is actually about that. And so I think it's an excellent question. And I was just a couple of weeks ago, when the Southern Baptist Convention story was breaking, a colleague of mine said, does this ever happen in, like, Reform Judaism? And I was like, yeah, it happens in Reform Judaism, but not to this extent. It's also, it has a lot to do with how big the organization is. So
yeah.
The Catholic Church is gigantic. Like, a quarter of Americans are Catholic. A quarter of Americans identify as evangelical Christians. So, like, that's a lot of people. So you have a big universe mm-hmm. to say to be being abused. Whereas,
you know,
like,
it never ever happens in the Presbyterian.
right. And so, I mean, I remember early on when I was covering this in Chicago. I was a reporter at WBEZ in Chicago who covered religion, and I remember there was, like, I was spending tons and tons of time on the Catholic clergy sex abuse because I just happened to be starting as the religion reporter in the middle of that, or at the very beginning of that crisis. But there was a trial going on of an ELCA pastor for sex abuse, and I covered that as well. It wasn't nearly as fraught, not because the abuse wasn't terrible, but because nobody was trying to cover it up. Like, as soon as it seems, all of the evidence, and this ended up in court, and he was convicted, it's like, as soon as somebody within the church was alerted, they dealt with it instead of trying to cover it up. And so this actually leads to something that we'll talk about when we get to the Catholic section, but I want to play for you a piece that we did very recently about Southern Baptist abuse. And I was very interested in this notion of what are the mechanisms of authority that allowed for this abuse to happen, and can the mechanisms that allowed for it to happen be the same mechanisms that try to stop it and rectify the situation. So I'll play this piece for you.
The release earlier this week of a list of sexually abusive ministers in the Southern Baptist Convention has prompted a lot of soul searching among church members. For some, it's been a time to revisit the chance of ordaining women or installing them in other leadership positions within the male-dominated hierarchy. Blake Farmer of member station WPLN in Nashville has this report.
When Jules Woodson's youth pastor coerced her into a sexual act, she reported it to her church within 24 hours. She went to his boss, the associate pastor.
Sitting there in tears, he stops me and he says, "So you're telling me you participated?"
She was just 17. She was told to keep quiet. The church would handle it. When nothing happened, she told some friends, who told their parents. Eventually, the senior pastor had to deal with it. This was 1998, outside Houston, Texas. The youth pastor was allowed to resign. The public line was that he'd made a mistake. Woodson says he was even thrown a going-away party.
They blamed me, they silenced me, and they failed to report it to the police.
Her abuser would go on to another church in Memphis. He resigned in 2018, soon after Woodson went public with her assault. As survivors of abuse in Southern Baptist churches come forward, it's almost always a man who decides how things will go, and that's by design. The denomination's policies reserve the role of pastor for men, citing New Testament scripture. But there was a time when the nation's largest evangelical Protestant denomination was on a path toward ordaining women.
I'm the first and last woman who did a PhD in preaching from a Southern Baptist school, like in the world.
Amy Mears studied at the flagship Southern Baptist Seminary in Louisville, but the door she opened quickly shut behind her as conservatives retook control of the denomination bit by bit.
It's not a surprise to hardly any of us
Mears now leads Glendale Baptist in Nashville, which dissolved ties with the Southern Baptist Church long ago. She says sexual abuse can happen in any kind of organization, no matter who's in charge, but men are far and away more likely to be the perpetrator.
I think systems that are founded on white heteronormative patriarchy are just sitting ducks for this kind of explosive, heinous sexual abuse scandal that we're now seeing in the Southern Baptist Convention.
Southern Baptists will be gathering in Anaheim for their annual meeting in 2 weeks. This is where church representatives would vote on something like a proposal to revisit the restrictions on women in leadership. Texas pastor Bart Barber is in the running to be the next church president. He says women could be given authority to handle abuse reports.
Well, I do think this crisis is a reason for us to make change.
But he says there's no need to upend Southern Baptist doctrine on male leadership.
I don't think it's a reason for us to make that change.
You're not going to invite feminists like me in to say, let's talk about how gender works.
Professor Susan Shaw teaches gender studies at Oregon State. She trained in a Southern Baptist seminary. She researches and writes about Southern Baptist women, though she's not one anymore.
I don't think that this is going to create an opening. I think there will be a lot of hand-wringing. Oh, we didn't know. Oh, we're so sorry. Oh, let's learn.
But Shaw says it's hard to imagine the denomination's male leaders giving up power. Those who have more progressive views may find their only option is to leave. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
So I'd like us to, as we have done throughout the week, pair up with somebody and think about the question of how the structures of power either work to enforce problems like this or could be used to fix problems like this. And I would like you to talk from your own specific denomination, religious tradition, faith tradition. I'd like to hear how you think the power structures that currently exist could be used to cover, but also to uncover abuse like this. You'll talk for 4 or 5 minutes, and we'll come back together. And again, as we have all week, you will be reporting on what your conversation partner says, not what you say. Okay, let's come back together. I want to hear what you shared with each other. So who would like to say what they heard from their conversation partners? Four, five, six, seven. Uh-oh, nobody volunteered by seven. What was that?
Hold on here.
So
I'm explaining what Glenn was saying.
Yes.
Glenn was a pastor, correct? Mm-hmm. And Glenn also worked as a psychologist for a long time, psychotherapist. And he saw a lot of the same kinds of power struggles and situations in his psychotherapy practice. And he made the point that whenever men have been in power for a long time in any institution or any profession, there's always this struggle. And he didn't take in women who had been sexually abused because he was afraid of the same kind of... No, is that not right? You didn't see them in your practice?
No, I didn't, but I would refer them out because I thought same gender work would be much more appropriate than me because of a lot of transference issues.
Right. Transference issues, right. Yeah. Like seeing him as a brother figure and, I don't know, playing out psychological issues. Anyway, We didn't come up with like a resolution or.
If you could have come up with a resolution in the 4 minutes I gave you, you'd win a Nobel or something. Other conversations that you would like to share?
Both my sibling here and I are ELCA pastors, and what I heard my sister say, I forget your name, sorry.
Janet,
sorry, I'm terrible with names. Is that we had a policy, and there were guidelines, and then there was trainings within the ELCA and other traditions that helped help clarify the expectations we had for clergy, but also open the door to people who had had that experience.
What do you mean by that?
So in other words, people who had had the experience of being sexually abused by clergy saw that the ELCA, with policies and procedures and a value statement, and then because we had female clergy, among other dynamics within the ELCA, people were able to finally come forward and be heard and believed, even though there was an investigative process in the very rare cases that someone made a false accusation.
Yeah, that is very, I'm glad you brought up the idea of a false accusation, because this comes up a lot. Like, quite often people will say, oh, people are just coming, they're reporting this because they want money, that it's a false accusation. Well, it's extraordinarily rare. It is so rare that there's almost no data to study much of it, because it is so rare. People don't confabulate the sexual abuse. I mean, however, I will point out that there's this very bizarre situation working itself out right now in the Sierra Pacific Synod, where there is some sort of investigation around abuse, but it's not entirely a transparent process. In fact, it's an extraordinarily opaque process. And so, like, we know that somebody reported something bad having happened. We hear, but we have no written report on that there was an investigation. And then, like, a few months ago at a synod assembly, this all sort of came to a head, and like within a few days, like resignations and investigations and disciplinary hearings. So it does happen within the ELCA. But there are procedures. The problem is you have to actually follow procedures. And so this is, I don't want to absolve this denomination, considering that, like, friends of mine, I was at my reunion, my college reunion, while that was happening. People were coming up to me because they thought I lived in that synod, and they were like, what is going on? So you have to ask Andy what's going on, not me, because he lives in that synod.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to say, like, I've uncovered sexual misconduct in 4 churches.
Right.
I've uncovered sexual misconduct in 4 churches, 3 of which were from former clergy. One was from a member that was concurrent to when I was there, and it still happens, and we have all of our problems. I will say that I do feel some compassion for the bishops who lived from 1990 to about 2015, because they had to deal with a lot of the past history. Mm-hmm. But cover-ups still happen, because we want to protect our reputations.
Right. Well, yes.
We had a struggle getting going, a little bit, because I think in many cases we don't even have a language how to talk about it. And when I mean language, I mean how do you create a meaning out of that crap? Mm-hmm. And when we talk about sexual abuse, I think it's really significant to define, what do you mean by sexual abuse? Do you mean something this, or you mean something that? And I'm always a little nervous talking about it, because I'm not a woman, and I've never been sexually abused. And anybody tried to do it, whatever I would do, it would end. But I've rarely met a woman of any age that hasn't at some point experienced a man going over the line. So if you're going to call that sexual abuse, then you've opened up a can of worms. So I don't even, like I said, I don't even know how to talk about it. Maybe I shouldn't be talking about it right now as a man. So.
Well, I do think it's interesting to be, so this is a problem in report. This is a journalistic problem where sometimes people don't want to talk about the specifics of what happened, but the specifics can be helpful in understanding what happened. And I'll give you this example from my own reporting. So one of the last stories I covered as a reporter was a Catholic priest. He confessed to the crime, so it was the allocution where he has to actually say what he did in court. And it was extremely detailed. Nobody who heard what he allocuted to has any question that what he was doing was abuse. Now, was it rape? Well, no, but he fondled boys, and then he fondled some under their pants, some over their pants. That's what he did. And my editor wouldn't let me talk about it. It's just all I could say was sexually abused children. And I think that part of there's this, like, people are embarrassed about talking, embarrassed to talk about the specifics. So people sort of say, well, maybe it was just, you know, a hand on her shoulder. Whereas most of the time, what goes to court, because no prosecutor would take a hand on the shoulder to court. Prosecutors take things to court that they think they can win. But for, you know, privacy reasons, sometimes those are held in family court if the kids are, or, you know, without reporters present if there are kids involved. But he had, what they did because it was an allocution is he actually just, it was victim one, victim two, so he had to allocute to each of those things. But I still to this day think that we did a disservice to our listeners by not being as specific as possible as to what he actually did. Because the very next day you saw people on TV saying, these were, you know, he was just being nice to these kids and he, you know, held their hand or something, and you know, and so like that's not what he did. He fondled them. And that, like, I think it's important to actually be specific. And I push my reporters to be as specific as possible when they're doing it for that reason. Which often means we end up having to put warnings on stories to say, like, this content might not be appropriate for all listeners, but I still think it's important to say.
Thank you.
Well, kind of going on that, that's one thing I've noticed too, is that different people have different definitions of what constitutes sexual abuse. So you have to take that into consideration because there's, I mean, what some older generations and some younger generations might think of as sexual abuse is completely different. So it's a lot of contextual things too, and that's what gets harder, is because you have some people that they know all the nitty-gritty details and they might think of the worst automatically, whereas some people might think it was the hand on the shoulder. And I think that makes it very drastically different.
Well, I want to play another piece for you. So earlier, I can't remember who mentioned this, but I alluded to the idea that sometimes the wrong people are blamed for the abuse. And that's all I'm going to say before I play this piece for you.
New revelations about hundreds of priests molesting children, mostly boys, have plunged global Catholicism into a deep crisis. The scandal has also deepened long-standing divisions within the church around issues of sexuality. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
The uproar over clergy sex abuse in the Catholic Church is no longer just about sex abuse. Some church leaders are using the crisis to promote a campaign against gay priests. Bishop Robert Morlino of Madison, Wisconsin, in a letter last month to Catholics in his diocese, said, quote, "We are talking about deviant sexual, almost exclusively homosexual acts by clerics." He was asked about that comment later in an interview on the Eternal Word television network, EWTN. Raymond Arroyo was the anchor.
Some will say, Bishop, reading this letter, that you are blaming homosexuality for the problems in the church and for the sex abuse crisis. You would say what?
I would say that homosexuality is at the root of this.
Researchers who have studied patterns of clergy sex abuse say they have found no evidence of a link with sexual orientation. But the notion that the problem of priests molesting boys and young men is related to the number of priests who are gay has been echoed by several conservative Catholic leaders. A few say the abuse crisis justifies a purge of gay men from the priesthood. Those reactions reflect continuing arguments in the church over sexuality and even over Pope Francis himself. He has advocated a more tolerant church culture with LGBT people in particular, and some Catholics don't approve. Official church doctrine holds that a deep-seated homosexual orientation is a moral disorder. The debate is now front and center.
Our church's very unhealthy attitudes about sexuality in general and homosexuality in particular really need to be addressed.
Marianne Duddy Burke of Dignity USA, a Catholic LGBT advocacy group, sees some church homophobia in the reaction to the clergy abuse crisis.
Whenever the church is under stress, particularly around the issue of sexual abuse of minors and the cover-up by the clergy, gay priests have been scapegoated.
Another cleric who has connected clergy abuse to gay priests is Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano, the former Vatican ambassador to the U.S. In an open letter released last month, Vigano blasted what he called a homosexual current in church circles. But Vigano also made a point that even critics like James Martin have to acknowledge: clergy abuse mostly involves male-on-male assault.
Clearly, the vast majority of cases are men preying on boys and adolescents. We have to be clear about that. But that does not mean that every gay priest is an abuser.
Martin is a Jesuit priest who writes often about LGBT issues in Catholicism.
The reason we have that stereotype is because there are so few public counterexamples of the healthy celibate gay priests, of whom there are hundreds if not thousands.
Martin thinks as many as 30 or 40% of Catholic priests are gay, but he says they're terrified to be identified as such in the current environment. The crisis also has political ramifications. In his letter, Archbishop Vigano singled out several top Catholic cardinals and bishops as being complicit in the abuse crisis. Almost all have been allied with Pope Francis and supportive of his agenda. Francis himself, Vigano said, should resign for having accommodated those men. In fact, Vigano is among the long-standing critics of Francis in the church. Again, James Martin.
What's happening, unfortunately, is that the suffering of children and the crimes of sex abuse are being used by people who have always been Pope Francis's critics as an excuse to dump on him, basically.
And it's apparently having an effect. A new CNN poll shows Pope Francis is now viewed favorably by just 48% of Americans, down from the 73% who approved of him at the beginning of his papacy. One more sign of how this sex abuse crisis in the Catholic Church has taken on wider dimensions. Tom Gelton, NPR News.
So, I'll tell you a little bit of background on this story, and then I want you to get together and discuss something based on what I'm about to tell you. This story was very, very hard to get on the air because it said things like 30 to 40% of Catholic priests might be gay. And I think that there was this, people did not want to talk about what we were really talking about, which is there is sex abuse and then there are gay priests. Those two things need to be disconnected, but I think that we ended up doing this story in part because Vigano and others, including the guy, was the Archbishop from St. Louis, was he? Keep talking about it so that we're forced to talk about it because they're talking about it. And so that it creates what I can't actually, sort of the opposite of a virtuous circle, a vicious circle of having to talk about something that isn't real because people are talking about something that isn't real. We all experienced this during the Trump administration. But I'd like you to turn to somebody different than the person you talked to a few minutes ago and talk about why we should tell these stories at all. What good does it do to tell these stories at all? And maybe I'm asking you to help me figure out why I should keep doing what I do. Okay. Why don't you take 3 or 4 minutes to chat with a different person than you talked to last time, and remember you're going to report back not what you said, but what you heard somebody else say. Yeah.
Well, what do you think?
I think as a
super conducive happening.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a
within that
very
group.
Clear binary of
it's
marriage,
right.
Marriage between a man and a woman and clergy. And
yeah.
It's,
okay, let's come back together.
You just
one or
say,
the other. And
you think they would just say, hey, you know there are gay men around there.
So I'd like to hear what
you know what I mean?
Heard
yeah.
from
within
your conversation
world,
about why these stories should be told, or maybe they shouldn't be told, and maybe that's how the conversation went as well. So who'd like to share what you heard?
How dare you, Jason?
What?
How dare you tell these stories?
How dare I? I will say that I have rarely in my career as a journalist been like physically confronted while doing a story. The one time that I was very clear in my mind, there was a large Catholic parish in suburban Chicago, and I was a reporter in Chicago, and the priest was arrested, this wasn't old abuse. This was like, he was arrested because he was then abusing kids. Arrested, taken out. I can say that because he was eventually charged and found guilty. So, but all I knew is that he was arrested and charged with abuse. So I went to the church and I stood on the edge of the property and I tried to talk to people coming and going. And I was chased away by the ushers, like physically chased away. And I was like, I'm on a public sidewalk. You can't be here. We're calling the police. You're harassing our people. I was like, I'm just asking if anybody wants to talk to me, I'd like to talk to them about the priest who was arrested here. And so, and as I turned to walk away, one of them yelled at me, "You're worse than the abusers because you're bringing scandal to the church." And that got me to actually thinking, and I didn't pull this piece to play for you, but we did a piece a few years ago about, there's actually a canon in the Catholic Church about not bringing scandal to the church. It's actually considered deeply problematic for church leadership to bring a scandal to the church. Thus, bishops who knew about abuse would just cover it up because they're afraid that like any scandal would harm the faithful, harm the faith of the faithful. I abide by no such canon. I have a much more truth will out approach to these things as a journalist.
How would not dealing with an issue and letting it fester and get worse, like what has happened over 30, 40, 50 years in the Catholic Church, how could that be a better idea than handling an abusive priest by the upper echelon in the church at the time that they determine that it was... that he was abusing people?
Yeah. It's a great question, and one that I think we will be trying to figure out for decades to come. It's in fact the subject of the very next piece that I'm gonna play for you, but I wanna give a few more people a chance to speak.
We have gay couples in the church I belong to. I'm not a member, but I've been going in there for 20-some-odd years singing in the choir, so I guess I belong. But our pastor, for the first time ever in our church, and in his pastorate for 30 years, we had a gay marriage in our church, and people were weeping. It was a beautiful ceremony. And the pastor said, aside from marrying my daughters, that was the most meaningful wedding I've ever conducted. And I talked to some people afterwards, and they were a little goofy about it. And I said, as I said in our group, have you ever known a gay man? Have you ever had a gay couple in your home? No, never had. Well, before you speak about this, you know, and you're blowing smoke, have a gay couple in your home and see what that feels like to you.
I think it's interesting that, like, that's where the people... The bishops in that piece that I played for you decided to go with, this is same-sex sexual abuse, and what they decided was that meant these guys were gay. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, gay men do not want to have sex with children. Gay men want to marry other men.
Yeah.
So,
right.
But I don't want to screw up how I say this. I think that there is something about if any expression of sexuality is wrong, as in you're celibate, you are a priest and so have to be celibate, then all expression is equally wrong. That might be part of what's going on. But likewise, if within Catholicism being gay is inherently disordered, which is what the Catholic Church teaches, inherently disordered, then, and abuse is inherently disordered, these inherently disordered things get conflated in people's minds. So I think that's possibly part of what's going on there. But it's incredibly difficult when you've got like the hierarchy of the church is like saying this thing that you have to like, well, wait, what they're saying needs to be untangled because like they're blaming something that isn't actually real, what you're talking about here. One more, and then I want to play a piece for you.
Or it acts as a distraction. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not comfortable to think about our children being molested in any way. But if you don't, like Glenn said, if you don't know anyone in that, you know, alphabet community, then it's easy to say, oh no, it's got to be them. It can't be us, it's got to be them.
I think it's also a distraction from the fact that these priests knew about it and spent decades covering it up, like actively working to not let the truth come out. So I often try to avoid playing pieces that I have personally reported because it feels a little bit weird to play my own voice over the sound system for you.
We'll pretend it's not you.
But this piece aired so long ago that I sound different. So I also had a cold when I did this one, so I sound both younger and stuffed up. So I'll just play this for you. This piece and the final piece, if we have time, are I especially like them because they are not straightforward about abuse. They are using the arts to discuss clergy abuse and other forms of sexual abuse within the church, not just clergy.
Is any sin so terrible it cannot be forgiven? Daily headlines about sexual abuse by priests in the Boston Diocese led playwright Michael Murphy to ask that question. Using documents relating to two civil sex abuse lawsuits, he found material for a new play involving the disgraced priest John Gagan, who was killed in prison last year, also Father Paul Shanley, who is awaiting trial, and Cardinal Bernard Law, the former Archbishop of Boston. The play is called Sin, A Cardinal Deposed, and is now playing at the Bailiwick Theater in Chicago. Chicago Public Radio's Jason DeRose reports.
Playwright Michael Murphy says what started out as research became an obsession. He spent weeks untangling 1,000 pages of Bernard Cardinal Law's legal depositions to weave a coherent narrative of what happened in the Archdiocese of Boston.
I just covered my entire apartment wall with the depositions. I had pictures of people that I copied off the internet or Xeroxed out of books and put on my wall to keep it all straight. And it all pointed back to the same thing, which is Cardinal Law, the center of this thing.
The play focuses on the Cardinal's negligence concerning the two most notorious perpetrators of child sex abuse in the Boston Archdiocese, Fathers John Gagan and Paul Shanley. In October, Murphy sent the script to the Bailiwick Theater in Chicago.
So this literally came in through the mail?
David Zack is the Bailiwick's artistic director.
I read it immediately, and we had called the playwright probably within 48 hours of the script arriving and said, this is what we want to do, and would you give us permission to do it? I think he was just as surprised as we were that it was such a fast process.
The cast rehearsed for only 3 weeks before Sin opened. Staging is simple, just two folding tables and a few chairs, legal and antiseptic. Save for Cardinal Law's priestly vestments hanging at the back of the stage, reminding the audience that the plaintiff's attorney is deposing a leader in the Catholic Church, not just another man.
Can you identify one priest who had allegations of sexual molestation brought against him, who was removed from parish ministry at this time? One priest!
I don't think there are any.
Did you ever think that there was some need for action? Even if it just involved getting the priests together and saying, this type of conduct is intolerable! Do you understand my question?
I understand the answer you want me to give.
That's the answer. No, I want to be cardinal.
Again, playwright Michael Murphy.
At some point, his desire to be the Archbishop of Boston, to be a cardinal, to be a player in the Vatican, became more important than his role as a shepherd, which is literally what a bishop is.
Victims and their relatives haunt the depositions with monologues Murphy culled from interviews he'd read in the Boston Globe.
And my child told me how everything had happened. He told me how Father Gagan threatened him. And in response, my child tried to run out our back door. But I pulled my son back and I told my son that I would never, ever stop loving him. And I told my son that no way could Father Gagan ever separate us. The thing is, it separated us.
Playwright Michael Murphy has dealt with profound tragedy before. He wrote a fictionalized account of the Columbine shootings, but he says using the real words of real people was more powerful.
There's an honesty and a lyricism that comes out of the human experience that's free of my playwriting tricks.
That honesty is exactly what Rob Scamardo, a clergy sex abuse survivor himself, found when he attended a recent Sunday matinee.
What I think the play will accomplish is to give people an opportunity to connect with the emotions of the survivors, the pain that they went through, and to see the attitude, the arrogance of the institutional church and how it dealt with claims against priests. That's what's not coming through in terms of the media reports.
Local critics have praised the work, and sold-out audiences are often in tears as they leave the theater. Scamardo and other survivors say sitting through the closing monologue is the most difficult and unspeakably sad moment in the play. It's Patrick McSorley's story of how, at the age of 12, Father John Gagan took him for a ride to get some ice cream, then molested him.
You know, he must have sensed that I was very uncomfortable with what he was doing because he ended up slowly taking his hand out and getting me back to my house. But I just remember getting out of the car and I was standing there with the ice cream all melted down my arm. Before he took off, I remember him saying, "Let's just you and me. No one else has to know about this."
Sin, a cardinal deposed, has turned out to be tragically timely. Patrick McSorley died of an apparent drug overdose just days before the play opened. In the end, McSorley didn't keep it to himself. He spent the last years of his life bringing Father Gagan and Cardinal Law to justice. For NPR News, I'm Jason DeRose in Chicago.
So I don't want to leave you completely bereft on a Friday afternoon. So I want to end by playing a short piece for you that I did right around the time I did that piece. This piece is almost 20 years old, and the other piece is also almost 20 years old. Sometimes people ask me, why do you tell sad stories? Well, part of the reason that I tell these stories, all this week we've been talking about sad stories, stories about abortion and abortion rights, stories about sex abuse, stories about white nationalism. Now, from the sort of journalistic mindset, it's that I feel like I can make a difference by telling those stories, as sad as they are. I feel like I can make a difference by telling those stories as sad as they are. But I also feel like it is important in many of these situations, the people who are being abused or having their rights taken away feel like they have lost their voice in public life. And so what I can do is give them a voice, or not actually give them a voice, I don't like that term. I can use my microphone as an amplifier for their voice. So I can help other people listen to their voices. They have them, I'm not giving them a voice. I'm helping their own voice come through by telling their true stories, even though they're sad stories. So I want to end with a piece that, it's one of the most fun pieces. I have enjoyed doing this story more than practically anything I've done in my entire career as a reporter. And it's just like 4 minutes long, and several of you attended some of, in fact, I know you attended one of these seminaries.
Yes.
So just take a listen and enjoy what you hear.
Here's something you probably didn't expect to hear out of the mouth of a seminarian.
My vagina's angry. It is. It's pissed off. My vagina's furious, and it needs to talk. It needs to talk about all this shit. It needs to talk to you.
Kat Cook is seeking ordination in the United Church of Christ. She's up on stage in a production of the Vagina Monologues because she believes talking about sex and sexuality is central to her ministry.
Even in some of our biblical texts, it's very challenging because you do have issues of violence against women. And unless someone stands up and even from the pulpit and says this is not right, then I don't know how much work we can do as a people or as a world, as a nation, to end the violence against women.
This is the fourth year a group of women from the United Church of Christ, Presbyterian, Lutheran, and Unitarian seminaries in Hyde Park is mounting a production of the monologues. This is Tara Schultz's first year in the production. She's a student at the Lutheran School of Theology, training to be a chaplain. She joined the production to raise awareness of sexual abuse and violence against women, political reasons. But for her, it quickly turned personal.
And I also am pregnant right now, and I think that it's important to embrace and affirm our vaginas when, you know, mine's going to be the doorway to the world for someone this summer.
Most seminarians are in their 20s or early 30s, so the directors of this year's production asked faculty to help out with the monologues about older women. 64-year-old Nan Hobart is the chaplain and director of vocations at Meadville Lombard, the Unitarian Universalist Seminary in Hyde Park. The monologue she performs is sad, or maybe better put, poignant. It's about a woman in her 70s.
Down there? I haven't been down there since 1953. No, it had nothing to do with Eisenhower. No. It's a cellar down there. It's very damp, clammy. You don't want to go down there. Trust me, you get sick.
The play itself juxtaposes generational attitudes toward sexuality, and Hobart has witnessed those differences in her work educating the next generation of female ministers.
I'm amazed at the young women in seminary these days. They're very comfortable talking about sex, talking about body parts in ways that even extremely liberal people my age still kind of have to get used to.
Despite the largely positive response from seminary faculty, some have raised questions about the appropriateness of some of the monologues. The concern hasn't been about frank talk about body parts or sex. Kristen Black is a student at McCormick Theological Seminary and co-director of this year's production. She says the controversy has arisen around monologues that depict possible child sexual abuse, a topic seminary students need to confront these days.
For instance, there's one called The Little Coochie Snorcher, where a woman meets another woman and they have an intimate relationship, and the younger woman is 13 or 16 and the older woman is 24. The monologues are not intended to promote that sort of behavior. It is just this one woman's story about how she came to love herself.
Black says she's glad the monologues are engendering talk about sex and sexuality at the seminaries because there's very little official coursework about this in their curriculum, so she's hoping this dialogue will make better ministers. The seminary's production of the Vagina Monologues is open to the public and runs tonight and Saturday. All proceeds from ticket sales and a silent auction will benefit the YWCA Rape Crisis Center and the organization Korean American Women in Need. I'm Jason DeRose, Chicago Public Radio.
So I played this, I went to a training workshop once. There's a bunch of public radio reporters there, and I was asked, everybody was supposed to bring a piece that they had done. And I played this for the room, and I still remember this, this one woman in the back of the room said, "I didn't know women could be clergy." And this was like 2000, probably this was written in 2004, maybe. I was really shocked that it never occurred to me to start by saying, women can be clergy. I just sort of assumed that if I had women clergy in a piece, that whatever that's saying. Well, I want to thank you all for coming to these sessions this week. I think you'll be getting feedback forms probably by email. So, you know, please do, I do pay a lot of attention to what people say, and if you like what I do or want me to do something different, please let me know. And again, thank you so much for coming and sitting through these sad stories, but I think they're important stories, so worth telling. Thanks.
Thank you.